From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan have killed at least 30 civilians in Helmand province. The airstrikes are part of a U.S. push to more aggressively attack Taliban forces on the ground. According to the Guardian newspaper, Afghanistan's NATO-led force said that Afghan government forces and U.S. advisors came under fire from Taliban fighters in a compound in Garmsir district and called in an airstrike, but the ground forces were not aware of any civilians in or near the compound. One survivor of the attack said that there were 16 children among the dead, and another said that there are still bodies buried under the rubble, which may increase the death toll. The U.S. strikes come just days after a major suicide attack in the capital, Kabul, killed five British staffers of a private security firm, and a separate bombing in Ghazni that killed three U.S. soldiers. The United Nations has estimated that there were more civilian casualties in Afghanistan in the first 9 months of this year than at any time since 2009. My guest is Brett Wilkins. He's a San Francisco-based freelance author and editor-at-large for U.S. News at Digital Journal. His work focuses on issues of war and peace and human rights. He recently published an article in Common Dreams about the Afghanistan bombing and the civilian casualties. Welcome to the program, Brett.
Thank you for having me, Sonali, and thank you for paying attention to a story that's overlooked by the mainstream media.
Yes, this is the longest war that the U.S. has ever officially been a part of, going on 17 years now. And this particular bombing with 30 civilians, minimum 30 civilians killed, I understand that the U.S. has admitted that it was its bombs that killed the civilians and that there were civilians killed.
I'm unaware that they've admitted it, because as is so many times in these cases that they don't and they fail to investigate. I think it's too soon. They've said that they were bombing in the area, but I don't think they've actually admitted that they've killed any civilians. That usually comes later after their inadequate investigations.
You know, it's interesting. I saw an article in, of all places, the Japan Times, saying that the U.S. admits that airstrikes caused civilian casualties, and they have an AP article. But I suppose we'll see. You're right that the usual means of the usual process is that the U.S. will deny and then investigate and then months later issue an admission when the dust has cleared. We're talking about so many children, as you know, of the 30 killed, more than half were reportedly children. Why have there been, as far as you know, so many civilian casualties, and why are the civilian casualties rising?
Well, this has been going on for a long time, but since taking office, Donald Trump, who we remember promised to, I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but he promised to bomb the out of Islamic State and kill innocent families. He's been living up to that promise, unfortunately. We've seen it in Iraq, we've seen it in Syria, and now we're seeing it in Afghanistan. I mean, this is nothing new. We remember that under Obama, there was the bombing of the Kunduz Médecins Sans Frontières Hospital that killed 42 patients and staff, and the United States changed the story four times, initially said that they had come under attack by Taliban, but then admitted that they hadn't. They always try to say that they're the most careful fighting force in the world and that they take great pains to avoid civilian casualties, but this just keeps happening and happening. They like to say that the Taliban and whoever else they're bombing, that they hide behind civilians, but in reality, you know, precision bombing isn't so precise. We've seen the use of weapons like the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan. We've seen a ramping up of what General Mattis, or now Defense Secretary Mattis, called from a policy of attrition to one of annihilation. And he said himself in a speech at West Point last year that civilian casualties are a fact of life in these situations. So while we see the rhetoric on one side, the action on the other shows that the United States doesn't seem to really care as much as they say they do about protecting innocent life. And on top of that, the Trump administration has loosened the rules of engagement meant to protect civilians. This started in Somalia, but it's throughout the seven countries that we're bombing right now.
United States, unfortunately, like many Western countries, often bases the cost of war on the lives lost from our own side, if you will. So I mentioned the attacks that came from forces on the ground, whether they're Taliban forces or other sort of fundamentalist warlords. I know that Islamic State is also somewhat active in Afghanistan, but regardless, there have been attacks on the ground aimed at the British security firm that lost 5 people and 32 injured and 3 U.S. soldiers killed, which is unusual. Do you think this will cause Trump and NATO allies to rethink their calculus?
Well, it certainly hasn't seemed to do that in the past. I mean, we've seen actually the opposite things happen. If you recall, in Fallujah in 2004, after I believe 5 Blackwater security personnel were tortured and killed there, that precipitated the actual invasion of Fallujah, which General Mattis at the time commanded. And we saw just egregious war crimes that were occurring there. Snipers killing civilians, surrendering, waving flags of surrender. What one general, I believe it was, not one general, sorry, it was Duncan Hunter, who served there in the Marines as an artillery officer, said was the last free fire zone in the war and the first free fire urban combat since Vietnam. So if the loss of American servicemen and women, which seems to be all we really care about in this country, if that's supposed to, put the brakes on further U.S. action, it seems to actually go in the other way more times than not.
Now, the Taliban have been the official enemy of the United States since the war began in 2001, just about a month after the September 11th attacks. Is it still the stated enemy of the United States? And why has it taken the United States so many years to tackle one ragtag army?
Well, we're dealing now with the longest war in U.S. history, aren't we? And it's interesting that it seems that Islamic State always seems to pop up in these places too. And now it's given as a rationale that we're not only fighting the Taliban or even marginalizing the Taliban or even discussing what would have been unimaginable some years ago, which is bringing the Taliban to the negotiating table and having them included in some part of post-settlement governance of Afghanistan.
So the bombing is a tool to bring an organization to peace talks.
Yeah, we've seen this before, haven't we? I mean, and it seems now that they just keep bringing up Islamic State as another reason why we have to keep doing this. And, you know, after 2,000 or more U.S. lives lost and 100,000 Afghan lives, 30,000 which are civilians, according to the United Nations, and 17 years of this, I mean, there are kids that were born. There are people fighting today in the U.S. military that were, you know, they could technically have been born after 9/11 because you can, you know, with parental permission, sign up at 17. So it just seems like whatever they're doing, it's not working. And the more that we bomb and the more that we intensify, the resistance keeps mounting. I mean, we've seen it every spring when the weather thaws out, the Taliban are resurgent, and now there's Islamic State. It seems like there is no end in sight. And we've seen this kind of talk before. I'm not old enough to remember Vietnam, but it seems that every year it was like that. There's light at the end of the tunnel. There's light at the end of the tunnel. Well, where is the light at the end of the tunnel? There doesn't seem to be any.
And of course, for Afghans, there are 17-year-old Afghans who have known nothing but the U.S. war. There are 30-year-old Afghans who have known nothing but war from different sources, both the U.S. and, of course, we had the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. We've had interference in Afghanistan from countries like Iran, Pakistan. So this is a war-weary nation, among the poorest nations on the planet as well. In terms of the increase in bombings by the United States, we have seen a corresponding, and you point out in your piece that you wrote, we've seen a corresponding increase in civilian casualties. This should not surprise us, right? When you drop more bombs, you will kill more civilians.
Well, I mean, since the nuclear war that we've waged against Japan in August of 1945, the United States has far and away killed more innocent men, women, and children outside of its own borders than any other armed force on the planet. Yet this gets very little coverage, and it seems that people really don't care. I've actually heard and seen people say, you know, we see these casualty figures, all the people care about are the ones on our side. So even though it's a relatively small percentage of the overall civilian casualties that are caused by the United States in these conflicts, if you add them all up, it's a staggering number. Low-end estimates, the Brown University Cost of War Project just came out with a low-end estimate of about 500,000 only in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan alone since 2001. Physicians for Social Responsibility estimates 1.3 million to as many as 2 million people have died. But yet you almost never see this covered in the corporate mainstream media. And you almost never see the United States, which claims to investigate and take it seriously. You almost never see in Raqqa in Syria and in Mosul in Iraq, thousands and thousands have been killed, beginning under the end of during the end of the Obama administration, but very much accelerating under the Trump administration. And you would never know this. They say the so-called liberal media, but when was the last time you saw any stories about this in the New York Times or on CNN or MSNBC even? I don't think American people know, and honestly, a lot of them don't seem to care very much about it. So, of course, it will continue to go on.
And unfortunately, the Afghanistan war has always struggled with becoming a serious enough issue inside the United States. You know, it was very soon eclipsed by the Iraq war, and you know, there have been some moments when it has become a serious issue. There have been some protests against this war, but by and large, it is a forgotten war. Do you also feel that the Trump administration has sort of put this war and its other wars into the hands of U.S. generals? Are we seeing the Pentagon take over the reins of commander-in-chief from Trump simply because he couldn't be bothered to do anything otherwise? And as long as it means justifying more military spending, he's fine with it?
You know, I mean, I hate to give the guy any credit for anything, but if you recall during his campaign, he was making some promising statements about, I remember him saying that the Iraq war was the biggest mistake that the United States have ever made in its foreign policy, and that he would find a way to end the war in Afghanistan, that he wouldn't engage in any wars for the sake of nation building. But we've seen that completely fall apart. I don't know why. I'm not privy to that. I suspect that if you asked for an honest response for a lot of the leaders of the military, they would tell you that it's an exercise in futility. But there are also certainly a lot of people that want to move up and further their own careers. And people like Mattis, who is held out to be, you know, the warrior monk, the great scholar, these are soldiers, and I think that there's an imperative amongst them to finish the mission. But again, this is speculation on my half. It's not my area of expertise at all to try to say why. But we definitely see a difference between the rhetoric that we heard from Trump during the campaign, which was, you know, a little more toward the libertarian or even progressive side when it comes to avoiding unnecessary overseas military adventurism and imperialism. We've definitely seen a difference since he's taken office.
Now, staying on the issue of Afghanistan, you see the numbers of deaths increasing since, and this year already, we've seen numbers that have surpassed previous years going all the way back to 2009. Now, at this point, what we're accepting is that these numbers are going to keep increasing because, like the Obama administration, the Trump administration doesn't seem to have a strategy for ending the war. They don't seem to have measurable outcomes and a strategy to achieve those outcomes, do they?
No, they don't. We hear a lot of nebulous talk about reasons why we shouldn't cut and run. For example, we hear about everything from the influence of regional powers like Iran to rare earth elements that are, you know, that the Chinese will get a hold of, which they will anyway. But they definitely don't seem to have a clear stated goal, and they definitely don't seem to have any sort of end game. And it just keeps going on and on and on. And one just has to ask, how much longer is this going on? 17 years now and counting.
What about the presence of private security contractors in Afghanistan? I'd mentioned that one attack in Kabul, the suicide attack in Kabul, that resulted in the deaths of five British security contractors with this one particular company. And I recall Eric Prince of Blackwater, over the past couple of years, has basically been trying to push Donald Trump, at least publicly, through op-eds, into turning over the war to private contractors. The entire, you know, let the mercenaries run the show, although he doesn't use the term mercenaries.
Well, these have always been a part, going back to Iraq, too. But, yeah, it seems like there's a conflict within the administration over whether how serious they are about pursuing that outcome and that eventuality. But as we can see, as we've seen in Iraq, you know, relying upon contractors, it has its whole, a whole other set of problems inherent in that, as we saw in Fallujah when the Blackwater contractors were killed. Or was it the Mansour Square massacre, also in Iraq, was committed by, I believe it was committed by private contractors as well. They're not subject to the same rules of engagement. They're not following the Geneva Conventions. They're operating independently, but then when things go wrong, the consequences come down on the United States. So it's a very dangerous path. I mean, yes, they claim they can save a lot of money and do it more efficiently, but at what cost, really, at the end?
Now, we've seen a lot of attention on the Yemen war and the Saudi, the U.S.-Saudi war in Yemen, and especially with the procedural vote that took place this week when the Senate, decided to go forward with pursuing ending U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. It's so interesting that that action came not because the U.S. basically had bloodied its hands through mass Yemeni civilian casualties, but over the exposure of the brutal killing of one person, one journalist, a Washington Post journalist. Horrific as that murder was, the Yemeni civilians don't seem to enter into the conscience of our members of Congress. And I'm wondering if the same holds true for Afghanistan. Wouldn't it be nice to see Congress vote on ending the Afghanistan war, or at least changing our direction there?
Absolutely. Great points. Well, you'll recall in 2001, after the September 11th attacks, the vote in Congress, I believe, was 435-1, with Barbara Lee, who represents across the bridge in Oakland, was the only one who voted against it. So that was considered, there was almost a sacrosanct quality to that, as if the first good war that we've been fighting since World War II. Of course, we know differently. And what you said about Saudi Arabia, I mean, even if we just it's incredible that that's what it took. The Khashoggi murder was what it took to get Americans to notice a country that's not only guilty of committing U.S.-backed atrocities and what's considered to be the world's greatest humanitarian crisis, but look at their domestic record even. I mean, Saudi Arabia, probably after North Korea, could be the most repressive place in the world, the most repressive regime in the world, and maybe the worst place to be a human being for just about everybody, unless you're one of the, you know, inner circle there. But yet that's been completely ignored by every single administration, regardless of political party, going back to the 1930s when, you know, the first oil deals were made between the United States and Saudi Arabia. So that was something that was really interesting to me, that it was Khashoggi. It took Khashoggi to get people to notice. But if that's what it takes to get people to notice, I mean, I don't know what chance this vote has, this resolution has of getting passed in the Senate. But we've come closer than ever. And there are some senators. Chris Murphy comes to mind. Ted Lieu comes to mind. Bernie Sanders comes to mind. Even on the other side, Rand Paul and even Mike Lee. There seems to be a stronger will to end U.S. support for this than there has ever been. So it's an encouraging sign, but I wouldn't hold my breath.
Now, in the Yemen war, the U.S. is, of course, selling Saudi Arabia weapons and providing intelligence. But in Afghanistan, it's the U.S. actually doing the bombing. It's the U.S. dropping bombs on Afghan heads. And it's U.S. soldiers also, to a much smaller extent, being killed, paying the price, being traumatized. And still no action by Congress that we can see. What about, as far as you know, the U.S.'s partners in the Afghan government? New-ish president, Ashraf Ghani, is quite happy to continue to have the U.S. presence there. But the former president, Hamid Karzai, who at one point was seen as a U.S. puppet, ended up near the end of his term wanting to see the U.S. get out of Afghanistan. I'm wondering if the Afghan government, corrupt as it is also losing patience with the presence of the U.S. there, because it doesn't seem to be making the country any better for anybody.
Well, you mentioned Karzai, and you know, this is all I could say about that is I recall as the years rolled on with that war, you would increasingly see Karzai make increasingly public statements, especially after these mass casualty events, against the U.S. presence there. I haven't seen Ghani speak out against the U.S., against NATO, against the intervention as we saw Karzai, who was quite vocal about it, if you recall, during the end of his administration, especially after incidents like the Kunduz hospital bombing and some other ones earlier that killed even more people than that. So I don't know what the Afghan government is thinking or doing, but I just know that publicly you just haven't seen Ghani really come out against it. And I don't know what that is.
Right. And Karzai, you know, spent years accepting and towing the U.S. line, and then only near the end spoke out. It certainly remains to be seen now what happens with, you know, even if the Taliban were to be defeated, the U.S. has installed a very corrupt government in Afghanistan, a parliament rife with warlords. Afghanistan just had parliamentary elections where, of course, there was tremendous violence around those elections. And it's not like the country doesn't have an appetite for democracy. Ordinary Afghans certainly seem to. But there are a whole bunch of armed warlords running around that have been, you know, with U.S. blessing, bent on controlling the country, and are waiting for the Taliban to fall so that they can do that. So all around, no real bright future for Afghanistan.
Yeah, we could be looking at another Iraq again. It could, you know, what could possibly go wrong when you go in and try to overthrow a country and, you know, create it in your own image? What could possibly go wrong? And it's a lesson that we still haven't seemed to learn. And there was, despite the promising language from the Trump administration, it doesn't seem that we're heeding any kind of historical lessons. I mean, Afghanistan is known as the graveyard of empires, isn't it? Who was the last one to really conquer it? Alexander the Great? I mean, so right. It's just not a situation we probably should have ever gotten ourselves into. And, you know, you heard some top level military people saying that, you know, after Tora Bora and after about 6 months in there, that there was really no reason for us to be there anymore. And we, you know, unwisely diverted our attention from trying to find Osama bin Laden to invading a country that had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. And it just seems like the U.S. foreign policy is rudderless and doesn't really have, you know, any point besides imperialism for the sake of maintaining, you know, for maintaining a power that's, quite honestly, seems to be on the wane. So,
well, Brett, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Where can people read your writings?
I'm on Common Dream, sometimes Counterpunch, sometimes antiwar.com. Everything is archived at www.brettwilkins.com.
BrettWilkins.com. We'll link to that from our website. Thanks again. Brett Wilkins is a San Francisco-based freelance author and editor-at-large for U.S. News at Digital Journal. His work focuses on the issues of war and peace and human rights. We've been discussing the U.S. war in Afghanistan. He wrote a recent piece in Common Dreams about it that we'll also link to. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.